Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is T.J. Morris, and you're listening to E.T. Radio. Welcome aboard, all you ground troops spinning around smartly on the planet we call home at the present time, Earth, Gaia, Sophia, other names out there, including the Blue Marble when you're out there in space. It is in the Milky Way galaxy on the very outside arm, which makes it strategically the place to be as far as people coming and going. And we're going to talk about that tonight because we're going to do an interview in Janet Carroll Lesson over in Maui, Hawaii with the Ascension Center. We'll be sharing this. We are simulcasting tonight. We have Lawrence R. Spencer, who wrote a book called Alien Interview, and it's a very great time to be alive to share this time on Earth, and we're going to try to figure out all this, but let me tell you a little bit about this author. Lawrence R. Spencer, he presently resides in California. He's the author of 9 books. His books explore facts and fantasies of universes, both physical and spiritual, including Western history, art, mythology, personal spiritual immortality, logic, and science fiction. Now, let me get Janet on here, and I'll finish reading what I have. Hello, Janet, can you hear me?
Hey, TJ, I was trying to play the intro to Ascension Center. You got to put it on, or simulcasting, you got to put it on so you can hear what I'm doing, because we were doing your intro, then my intro. So, anyway, let's just, but I just
okay.
Let you know what was going on. They were playing two things at once.
Okay.
You were introducing Lawrence Spencer, so that's
yes.
Our guest
is
today,
has your music already played in your intro? So
no, you were supposed to do yours and then listen for mine,
right.
And then I
well, go
say
ahead
hello
and play
and
yours.
You can...
Go ahead and play yours, and then I'm going to read the rest of this accounting.
Hold on, I'm going to play the intro. One second.
Thank you.
Hold on. I'm going to play the intro.
Welcome to the Ascension Center, a virtual reality of expanded consciousness. At the Ascension Center, we feature ideas designed to facilitate ascension, moving from this dimension to higher levels of awareness of the continuum and all creation. Here together, we become conscious and aware of the illusion, the delusion that keeps us disconnected, unaware that we are all one. United, we excel, propel existence led by love, create a new, peaceful planet with less resistance to positive possibilities, the highest good, love, light for all beings. Together, we transcend, become the accelerated, ascended, enlightened, angelic beings we all know we are deep inside.
Okay. Welcome everybody to Aquarian Radio at AquarianRadio.com and TJ Morris ET Radio with Teresa J. Morris as the host, and I am Jeff Carolett. And today we have Lawrence Spencer as our special guest. TJ is going to read an introduction about Lawrence. Is there anything else that TJ wants to say? Go ahead, take it away.
Hi, everyone. On the other show out of Maui, Hawaii, I am presently in Beaver Dam, Ohio County, Kentucky. Welcome, everyone, on both sides of the United States of America. We're talking about Lawrence R. Spencer, who's the author of 9 books. I just introduced him. And Mr. Spencer also has a special interest and expertise in the books of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, to whom the book Sherlock Holmes, My Life is Tribute. As an accomplished oil painter himself, Mr. Spencer has made a groundbreaking study of the life and paintings of the Dutch master Johannes Vermeer, about which the book Vermeer, Portraits of Lifetimes, is written. Mr. Spencer is also the editor of the book Alien Interview, including transcripts, letters, and personal notes provided by the late Army Air Force nurse Matilda McElroy concerning the Roswell UFO crash in 1947. Now, Mr. Spencer is a business consultant and multimedia producer. His internet blog contains personal commentary, literature, and poetry about life, universes, and other stuff. So he must be a really down-to-earth kind of guy. He sounds like he talks like us. But Janet, I'm looking at his picture and his books on Lulu.com, and I understand they're also available on Amazon as well. His personal blog website for the book Alien Interview and blog about the book. But we have Lawrence R. Spencer. Is that .com? Janet, would you like to take over now for our listening audience?
Okay. So,
you're breaking up on my end. I don't know if it's recording that way.
I might have to call in to the show. This, what do you call it? Skype has been acting up lately, and it sounds okay from my end, but if it's not, maybe what I'll do is mute this and call in. But in the meanwhile, welcome, Lawrence, to our show. Mr. Spencer, how are you today?
I'm good, JT. It's nice to meet you.
Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you. Janet's
it's TJ.
Breaking up, but I can hear you fine.
Okay, what I'm going to do is call into the show. that. Could you please add anything you'd like to bio to tell our listeners about yourself?
Yeah, I think actually your description is quite good. The only thing, the only exception is that I've retired from business consulting and I'm retired from my corporate working life and have focused my attention for the past 5 or 6 years only on my blogs and my books and that sort of thing. I'm probably 68 years old in August, and I've done everything that I ever wanted to do in the business world and a lot more that I didn't want to do. So it's a pleasure to be able to focus my attention on my own personal creative pursuits, including writing and researching for a new book that I'll publish next year based on the worldwide responses that I've received to the Alien Interview books.
Alien Interview, which is very exciting, and I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about the book and how you came to have it. Okay, hold on. I'm going to switch from one to the other.
Yeah.
Go ahead and talk to you.
Okay. Lawrence, while she's getting her little technical difficulty worked out on her board, it has to do with her using Skype, folks, is what that is. But regarding your past history, Lawrence, would you mind helping us on our show over here? What we do is we like to get to know you when basically the name you were born with, where you were born, get to know you personally a little bit in this lifetime, just who you are and how you perceive yourself growing up, if you don't mind, before we get into the actual interview of the book. Could you let us know a little bit more about you, just like where you went to high school and what it was like growing up?
Sure. I was born in Michigan in 1947. I lived there with my parents on a rural farm in southern Michigan until I was about two. And my father left the Navy a couple of years following the end of World War II and went to school and became a watchmaker and got a job in Northern California where his family, near where his family lived in San Francisco. So we moved there and I grew up essentially in Northern California in a couple of different locations, both in the Sierra Nevada Mountains and in the northern Sacramento Valley in a little town called Red Bluff. Went to high school, graduated there, and left there and went to college in Sacramento, California for several years and then moved to Hawaii for years and went back to California, eventually moved to Florida, lived there for some time, moved back to California again when my father passed away to take care of my mother and have remained in Northern California since then. I now live in a little kind of retirement resort community. It's not actually little. It's 11,000 residents and 7,500 homes. I live on the 10th tee of a golf course and with my wife and my cat. And my life is very sedentary, and I spend most of my time on the computer.
Well, that sounds like a great life. Did you have any children along that path?
Four children and seven grandchildren.
Congratulations on that. All right. Janie, are you back?
Can you guys hear me? Yeah, can you hear
me?
Yeah.
Much better,
good.
Janie.
Okay.
You must be calling in on your phone.
I just called in on my home phone. So I missed that, Lawrence. Are you still married right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, my wife and I have been together for 20 years. And I was telling JP, I have, between us, we have seven grandchildren from different partners.
Seven grandchildren.
Oh, okay. Wonderful,
and
Lawrence.
And four children. How old are your
five
children?
Children.
Oh, five children.
Yeah, between my wife and I, we have five children. I think the oldest sons are 40-something.
Uh-huh.
you know, so, you know, they've long since grown up and have their own families and so on and so forth.
Well, we're all the baby boom generation. CJ is right in the middle, and I'm the youngest of the three, and you're the same age as my eldest brother, but I'm the baby. But I didn't have any children. TJ had, how many children did you have? Four, right?
Yeah, I was born the day after Christmas, 1951, and I married and had four daughters. My husband worked at NASA. He's passed on. But Angela, Lauren, Stephanie, and Gigi, and they've all had interesting encounters in their life. And I'm real excited to actually talk to you, Lawrence. I was surprised that we were already friends on at least three of my Facebook accounts.
we have 800 mutual friends on Facebook, so it's like we're already family.
Well, I have Teresa and TJ, and I didn't know if you knew, but there's two or three of my pictures on your page, and I was like, oh.
Yeah.
I started talking to myself.
We know each other.
Yeah, when I saw you, when Janet told me that you were going to be joining us on Univia, I know her. I know who she is. We've never corresponded, but I knew who you were, of course.
Well, thank you. What exactly did you know about me other than my Facebook page? And which one? The blonde, the redhead, and the long white hair.
The long white hair one. That's the one.
Okay.
I'm familiar with.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, I'm excited to hear your voice, and I know a lot of people. I've sent out about 1.4K, it says, so 1,400 when I was just sitting punching buttons and biting people, so we should have a good guest list off of those that I did put, and then I put on TJ Marcy's radio page as well just at the last minute before I got on the show going. So hopefully between you and I, we'll have a lot of friends that get to hear us talk to each other. So it's an exciting day for me, and I know it is for Janet. She's been looking forward to interviewing you, and I agreed to just sort of sit back and let her take over because this was her idea. So if you don't mind, Lawrence, I and my listening audience is going to sit here, and then I think we'll do a little short MUFON commercial, if you don't mind, right about 9 o'clock, and Janet can watch the clock. She's good at that. And I'll play that, and then we'll come back and do the last hour and maybe do some Q&A and all of that, but I think that's the way Janet and I felt most comfortable, is letting Janet speak so we didn't talk over each other. So go ahead, Janet.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now we worked out our glitches.
Yes, we
did. Okay, so I have been listening to your YouTubes and reading a little bit on your book, and it's a fascinating subject about the gray for the crash, and her name is Ariel, A-R-I-L. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you came by these materials that are the results of this book called Alien Interview?
Of course. In the late 90s, I was doing research for the first book I wrote and published called The Oz Factors, which was published in 1997. For several years, myself and my editor, the editor of the book, Carol South, who has since passed away from breast cancer, were working on preparing this book. It's a fairly lengthy nonfiction book about the genesis and evolution of Western logic, such as it is. And it's very thoroughly documented and researched, and I spent several years reading several hundred books. At that time, the Internet was not really yet available, and there wasn't much content on the Internet. So my research was all from, you know, going to the library and purchasing books and, you know, wading through original material. So when that book was being researched, somewhere along the way, my editor came to me and said, I have a phone number that was given to me of some woman who might know something about Roswell. And I wasn't the least bit interested in Roswell or UFOs, and that's not what the book was about. I wasn't really doing research along that line. But she was a great fan of Art Bell.
Yeah,
the After Dark show, and she used to stay up until the wee hours listening to Art Bell. Well, I was working as a corporate executive at that time. I didn't have time to. I had to be in bed. I couldn't stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning. But And she was a faithful follower of Art Bell. So I think that somehow, circuitously or serendipitously, she got this phone number. She gave it to me, and kind of on a lark, I called the phone number, and this woman answered the phone, and I introduced myself, and I thought, I'm doing research for this book, and here's what the book is about, blah, 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 and I understand that maybe perhaps you know something about Roswell that could be made a part of this book. And she said, well, I can't tell you anything about that. And that's about all she had to say about it. So I said, she was very gracious and interested in what I was telling her about the book. So I said, well, when I finish the book, I'll send you a copy of it. So I think it was published maybe a year later or something. And she was very gracious, and she gave me her mailing address. So when the book was published, I sent her a copy. Totally forgot about it. Never had any other discussion, never conversation, contact with her at all. And that was about 1997. So 10 years later, I received an envelope, a big envelope in the mail from Ireland. And at the time that I had spoken to her, she was living near an Air Force base in Wyoming or Montana. I forget, it says in the book. Actually, in the book, it says the address, I believe, of where she was living at that time. Anyway, so I received this big envelope of documents from her, from Ireland. As I said, totally had forgotten about it. I opened it up, and inside were what are now the contents the book, Alien Interview.
There's some kind of noise coming from your side, clicking or something. Do you have your headset on?
No, I'm on the phone. I'm not touching the computer. If anybody's typing on the computer or that does make noise. So are you typing on the computer, Mark?
I'm sitting very still.
No, it might be me. I'm wearing a headset, so I'll hold the microphone in my hand. So
there you go. I think that might be it.
Okay.
Around.
Is that better?
Thank you, Janet. Yeah, thank you both, Lawrence and Janet. I just know that on my end, it's recording, and I could hear the clicking, so I know if I can't hear you good, that means that it won't be taped well, and the listening audience will hear the clicking, too. Thank you. Thank you, Lawrence.
Okay.
It just makes for better listening. Thank you, dear.
Okay, of course. So anyway, I received this envelope, and given the nature of the information and the content of the envelope, I was really kind of shocked and taken aback and frightened and everything simultaneously, because the envelope contained copies of what appeared to be U.S. Army Air Force top secret documents typed, you know, on a typewriter, manual typewriter, together with letters written by her, some of which were typed and some which were handwritten on various kinds of paper, interspersed between the pages of the transcript documents. So
was
in her,
the original or a copy?
It appeared to me to be an original. I mean, it appeared to be typewritten. I'm no expert on these things, of course, but the paper was definitely aged and had been folded, and it was appeared to me to be an original typewritten document, which she explains in the letter and the notes that she sent as to what the documents are and how she came to be in possession of them and why she was sending them to me and so on and so forth. That's all in the book. So in her letter, she asked me to publish the material, the interview transcripts, because she felt that this information needed to be known and had been covered up since 1947 very, very aggressively by the military. Of course, we all know that the whole incident surrounding Roswell UFO crash has been very, very aggressively covered up to this day, more than 60 years later, still aggressively covered up. So when you read the content of the interview transcripts and so forth, it becomes very apparent why that incident was covered up. So anyway, long story short, she asked me in the letter to publish the material because she was at that time 83 years old, and she and her husband had decided to leave the body and commit suicide and move on to wherever, and they had gone to Ireland to do that. I was very, very wary of the material, first of all, because I'm no expert on documents, it could easily be a hoax or fabrication, although it all looked genuine to me, there's no way of knowing for sure. But because the documents were obviously labeled top secret, and because of the nature of who sent them to me and where they came from, allegedly, I didn't tell anybody about it. Nobody, not my wife.
Because
mm-hmm. I was afraid that being in possession of these documents, which were stolen, in fact, they weren't given to the nurse. She didn't have any authority to have a copy of these documents. So I was really afraid that you know, if it were known that I had this information, that somebody from the military or intelligence agencies or whatever would show up and take me away, put me in prison, shoot me, kidnap my children.
I was just wondering, with the documents, like, how did they make copies of documents back then when there was no Xerox machines? Even if they were to make copies, so when
when you read the information in the letters that the nurse wrote, she said that her copy was actually not a copy; it was the original type document of the recording of the transcripts, the interview between herself and the alien pilot of the crashed UFO at Roswell. And the reason
were
that she had the original.
Were there copies made of those?
According to what she says, there were a number of copies made and distributed to intelligence officers who were present, who were supervising the interviews, military, the very, very elite top brass of all of the branches of military and lots of other people involved in governmental agencies, military
services,
CIA,
NSA, how did they make copies back then? Oh, they had the, they would do in the high schools where they,
as far as I know, in 1947, they had carbon paper. That's what they had.
Carbon paper, plus they would roll them out on that purple stuff, whatever that was.
A sheet of carbon paper between several pieces of paper, and if you type really hard, you could get it the carbon to go through several sheets of paper and make three copies at once or something like that.
Yeah, and the government is always ahead, right, of what we have out of the public anyway.
Yeah, she doesn't say anything about that other than the fact that at the end of the interview process each day, that there were a bunch of typists there, and transcriptionists who would write down what was the interview in shorthand, I gather, and it was typed into normal text by a number of different typists, and then those copies were distributed to the various military intelligence agents and military personnel that were there during the course of those interviews, which lasted 6 weeks. So, but her copy, she says, was the original copy, which she says in her letter, she was not authorized to have it. Essentially, she stole it, and no one knew that she had it. So this is what I received.
She was in the room, and one transcriptionist was allowed in, and then the rest was the typing pool. Is that your understanding?
We can infer that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because she says that her interviews were conducted in a closed room that had two-way glass on one side through which a lot of other people could witness the interviews.
Yes.
She refers to them as the gallery, and she names names. She is, during the course of the her notes and so forth, she runs off a long list of names of the personnel who were present, especially various generals from branches of military and other personnel that we brought in during certain stages of the interviews to assist or supervise or, you know, charge to do it, some sort of a cross
interrogation. Such as Helen Cotter, possibly, General Helen Cotter possibly was one. Helen Cotter.
Well, the
name, remember that?
The names are listed specifically in her letters, and they're all included in the book. So what I did was I after reading through all of this stuff and kind of organizing it into what I thought was kind of a chronological fashion, it all seemed so strange and far-fetched and unbelievable to me, which she said in her letter. This is going to seem really unbelievable to anybody who reads it. So I spent about 6 months researching as best I could. Of course, by that time, I had access to the Internet, of course, and was sophisticated at using the Internet. So I spent lots and lots of time on Wikipedia, primarily, and other websites to see if I couldn't verify for my own edification that the information in her letters and in the transcripts was true. Could it be verified? Is there proof of it? The names, the places, the dates, and so on and so forth. So after about 6 months of doing that, I was convinced that the information was genuine enough, in my estimation, to warrant being published. But I did write a very thorough disclaimer at the beginning of the book saying, I'm no expert, and anybody who reads this needs to do their own research and figure out for yourself what to believe and what not to believe. It's not my job as the editor to do anything more than assemble it into a book form and get it published, which is what I did.
What year was that you finally got it published?
Sorry?
What year was it that you finally got it together in a form and published it?
It was published in 2008.
Okay, 2008.
So I published it in 2008 through a self-publishing company, Lulu.com, and same day, it's a paperback book, and the same day I published it as a free PDF on the Internet. I posted it on the Internet so that it could be accessible to as many people as possible. Some people like to have a printed book. Some people don't. So I figured, well, I'll just put it on the Internet, and anybody who wants to read it or do whatever can do so.
So how has it been received? How has your sales been?
Well, in the years since that, 6 years, I can only estimate, but I gather that at least hundreds of thousands of people have read the book.
Hundreds of thousands have read it, yeah.
At least. Probably more like millions, I'm guessing, but I have no way of verifying that. The book has been translated into 7 languages by volunteers who are just so enthralled by the material that they asked permission to create a translation of it into. It's been translated into Spanish, German, French, Russian, Korean. Currently being translated into Chinese, Japanese, Portuguese. The Hungarian translation is almost done. And a number of other translators have been contacted by volunteers to help, translate it into other languages. So the book has been produced as an audiobook by Audible.com. It's been produced as a Spanish audiobook by Audible.com, and without the footnotes. But an audiobook version of the book has been produced, including the footnotes also, and that'll be published later this year or next year. A film is being produced based on the book. Anyway,
where are you in the process of the film being produced?
script has been written.
Mm-hmm. Script
is written. It's currently being, being doctored and made ready for, to be presented to various funding sources and so forth. But the film producers are very, very credible and very, very professional and highly accomplished in their field, both in television and film. But
are you allowed to tell us who's producing it?
I'm sorry?
Are you allowed to tell us who's producing it?
No, I am not, absolutely.
Not yet. Okay, that's fine.
No. I think that's kind of the way it goes in the film industry. You can't say anything until after the film has been released or something. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, unless you're doing sports 3 or 10 or whatever.
Yeah, anyway, so there's been lots and lots of attention paid to the book. And I've received personally, it's sort of kind of overwhelmed my personal life. I think I spend probably 8 hours a day answering emails and corresponding with people about the book and doing radio interviews and doing I have a blog that I've created for the book where I put the information from the book with supplementary information that I find or has been sent to me that expands upon or verifies the content of the information in the interview transcripts. So the blog has now, 10,000 subscribers.
So this is quite a success. So maybe what we could do now is tell our listeners a little bit more of the meat of what is this book about? Because I'm sure they're all sitting on the edge of their chairs like, tell us what this book is.
Answer one question before it's asked, which in every interview I've ever done, I think they ask me, what happened to the transcripts?
Yes,
answer to that is I burned them on my barbecue.
And why did you do that? I know the answer. Why did you do that?
Including the envelopes, the letters, the documents, and everything. And the reason I did that was because at that time, I was frightened. I was very frightened to be in possession of some material because of what the nurse says in the letters. She says, I don't want you to endanger your life by publishing this material. Many people have been killed to keep this information secret. So I didn't want to become another death certificate or body in the morgue. So I said, if I burn the material and if I'm not actually in possession of it, then I can't be convicted of a crime. So as soon as the transcription was done, I burned everything. And so I'm no longer in possession of any documents of any kind. Nor did I want to give those documents to anyone else and endanger their lives either, or the lives of my children or whomever. So
right.
Anyway, I admit I'm a coward, and I don't know the respect. In retrospect, I don't know if that was necessary or if that was the right decision, but I just put an end to it. I didn't want to take any chances.
Go ahead, Katie. You have a question?
I just right here, since we're at this specific point for the official document, because there will be many people, being that I've worked in and outside the government, asking this question, but... regarding the top secret document that the whole book is based on, were there any stamps that you can recall or anything other than top secret?
No, there wasn't anything. It was just typewritten. Everything about it was typewritten. So
because she had just grabbed it and stuck it in her suit, and she didn't.
Yeah, it was the original copy.
Yes. It did not have time to circulate outside of that room when she was taken. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's what she says. And it's interesting that...
Well, didn't she need to have the original... She needed a copy for her own use to review what was said, correct?
For two reasons. She was given a copy by the military intelligence people to take into the interview room and ask the alien pilot to sign it to verify and then authenticate that everything that she reported in their interview process was accurate and true.
Mm-hmm.
And this is described in detail in her letters, which are also published in the book. It says she, the pilot, refused to sign the document saying, you're a member of this military unit, and if your officers and won't trust you to carry out their orders and protect their best interests, why should they take the word of somebody from an extraterrestrial race of beings who are obviously of a highly superior military capability and so on and so forth? So she refused to sign it. So at which point the nurse put the copy of the document that she had for the pilot to sign in her blouse or her uniform jacket pocket or whatever. And at that instant, several MPs and a...
Wait, is this not given that away yet? Let's go back in time. That's kind of like the punchline of the story.
Oh, okay, yeah, this is the very... Yes, it's the very...
Yeah, so we're gonna save that, listeners, for later, what happens, because that's the end of the saga. So let's go back to...
In the beginning was a crash in Roswell, folks.
Yeah, in the beginning was the crash in Roswell, and that's very famous and infamous, and there are many, many, many wonderful books written about Roswell that are thoroughly researched and documented, and I've been informed in as much as I was in no way an authority on anything having to do with Roswell's or UFO or anything like that. I've never really paid attention to it. But I've been contacted subsequently by several of the world's leading authorities on the subject of Roswell, including Ron Gardner, who was the curator of the Roswell Enigma Museum for 15 years and still is, and has published many, many, many documentary films and interviewed personally on video 100 people who were witnesses to the events of Roswell in 1947. So he assures me that everything about this material is quite authentic. And several other former CIA agents or government agents have verified, has said the same thing. So I just have to take the word for it because I have no firsthand knowledge. The only thing I know about it and everything I know about it is the envelope and what was inside the envelope. And that,
So how did Matilda end up being at the crash? Let's begin at the beginning. So she was at the crash.
Yeah, she was stationed at the 509th Bomb Group in Roswell, New Mexico, which is the Air Force base there from which the Enola Gay, the bombers that dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1946 at the end of World War II, those bombers were stationed there at this base. It's about 100 miles from the Alamogordo Atomic Research Center, where they did all of the development and testing of the original nuclear bombs and the bombs that were used to drop on Japan.
Right.
So she was stationed there as a flight nurse. She was, I believe, 23 years old at that time, and she'd recently graduated from nursing school, and as I understand it from other sources, there were several other nurses who were also stationed there at that time, all of whom disappeared immediately thereafter, were never heard from again. And various stories have been told about how
they disappeared the day after the crash shortly after
the bodies that were recovered from the crash were shipped off to either Texas or Ohio, to other Air Force bases. All the nursing staff and all the medical personnel who were associated or had seen the bodies recovered from the crash all disappeared forever, and nobody ever heard from them or about them again. This is what my understanding. Obviously, the nurse who did the interviews and had the transcripts, she says that when the interviews were completed, she was taken away and put into a witness protection program where she remained for the rest of her life, for 60 years.
Which we would like to think that's what happened to the other nurses. Janet, should we take that one-minute break right now and then get into the nitty-gritty of the story since we didn't take it right on the hour? Should we take that 1 minute?
No, so we have another
46 minutes. 45 minutes left.
Oh, only 46 minutes? Okay.
It went by really fast. Oh. Yeah. Okay.
Well, shoot,
you want me to...
mine's going to end. I'm going to have to call into yours. Oh, damn. Okay, you've got a recording going on your end. Okay, it's okay. We'll take a quick break here, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes. Go ahead, take it away.
Call back in, and I'll put you back on, Janet, okay? All right?
Okay.
Call my show. Yeah. And Lawrence, what's happened is hers dropped off. So we're going to plug her back into mine so she's recording at the same time, we hope.
Okay.
All right,
folks.
We've
got to pull in Lawrence, too. I'll tell Lawrence what to do. Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, folks. We're going to hold stand by, and I will have a short break here, and then we're going to get into the details of the alien interview, because we've been covering the author. Now let me get a quick 1 minute break here with MUFON. Here we go.
The Mutual UFO Network was established in 1969 as a nonprofit volunteer organization dedicated to the scientific study of UFOs for the benefit of humanity. MUFON's goals are to objectively investigate UFO sightings and collect the data in the MUFON database for use by researchers worldwide, and to educate the public on the UFO phenomenon and its potential impact on society. The Mutual UFO Network is recognized as the leading UFO research and investigative organization on the planet, thanks to MUFON's vast network of dedicated volunteers, like-minded individuals who share the same interest in being part of a group that has brought UFO investigations into the new millennium. Are you interested in becoming a member of MUFON? There's never been a better time to join the network. So for more information, log on to MUFON.com. That's www.MUFON.com.
Okay, everyone. This is TJ Morris with ET Radio. We are live and on the air with Lawrence R. Spencer. However, Lawrence, are you there? Okay. What happened, folks, is Janet and I are both simulcasting my show. I record for 2 hours, and she does one-hour intervals. It's just something that's easier to get marketed out there on one-hour intervals. But I'm going to call back her phone number, and we'll get them back online here. Here we go. So you may hear something happening here while I call her back. I heard her say, oh, shoot, and I think what happened was she realized she was not recording. So we'll just have to see how that goes. But as she said, we have the thus far up to this point recorded, and when we're doing a live radio, we just have to work with what we've got. So we'll see here if
Blog Talk Radio.
Keep going. That's
welcome
live
to Blog Talk Radio. If you desire to speak to the host, please press 1 at any time, and the host will be notified that there is a caller in queue. Otherwise, please hold and you will be able to listen to the show.
Okay. Janet? Okay, let's see here. Janet, hi. I've got you live. Yes. Now, I'm not sure, but you're still plugged in on your show, but I called in again to your show. So am I talking to you on your show and on your personal line?
I'm not sure. Let's see. I'm going to put the mic on. Mic on.
Unmuted.
Okay. I cut the show off, and I can.
I'm going to text
turn
you
one of
Lawrence's
them back on.
Number. No, don't call into my show. I'm going to just download your recording and overwrite my recording. So because mine's saying I only have 10 minutes left, and I'm not sure what happened there. So I'm going to text you Lawrence's phone number. You'll call him from your show, and we'll just continue the second hour.
Is it a 916 number? Because he may have figured out.
No, I don't want to say his number.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't want to tell the world his number. That's not right. So I will just text you that and on your cell phone. So look for that in 1 minute, and then you can call him from the back end of
on
your
my
show.
Cell phone. Okay, folks, there is a California number on my board, but let me just make sure that
see if that's Lawrence before I go.
Hi, Lawrence. Did you figure out how to break the code and get into my show?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay, good.
I got
brilliant.
A text saying call this other number, so I did.
Yeah, I texted Lawrence to call. I'm glad you're computer techie savvy because, you know, you can do that. Not everybody of our generation knows how to do that. So I'm going to end my show, and then when we do the archive, I will download and upload the show that you're recording. We're recording two shows here, and a good thing, because some reason mine was going to end in 9 minutes. So we're going to continue next hour.
Okay, I've still got your
TJ
recording.
Show.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you for using Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye.
Okay. I take it
now
you just
we're on
in?
Yours.
Okay.
I ended mine so we didn't have any feedback because we were getting a loop, a loop-de-doop-de-doop.
Okay. So now we are going to start the story of the Roswell UFO crash in 1947, and we can go about why we think that crash happened. And basically, Lawrence R. Spencer is the editor of the receiver of the top secret document, the only top secret document, of a particular visitor from space that we understand was at the original Roswell crash on or about July 4th through July 7th. I don't know that we ever got the exact date.
1947?
Yes, 1947.
She said, the nurse says in the transcript said it was July 7th, but she
July
7th.
Thank you. Glad to have that clarified. That's important because
that's
many
not necessarily the date of the crash, but that's the date that she became involved.
Oh, okay.
She doesn't actually say explicitly the date of the crash. She just says July 7th is when she went to the crash site.
So she went to the crash site. Okay, does she say what she saw or heard when she went to the crash site?
Yeah. In her first letter, I have it up on my screen here. I can actually read you a few paragraphs from her description.
That'd be great.
What occurred when she arrived? She says, "You may not know that I was enlisted in the U.S. Women's Army Air Force Medical Corps, which was a part of the U.S. Army back then. I was assigned to the 509th Bomb Group as a flight nurse at that time, at the time of the incident. When the news that there had been a crash was received at the base, I was asked to accompany Mr. Cabot, the counterintelligence officer, to the crash site as the driver of his vehicle to render any needed emergency medical assistance to any survivors if necessary. Therefore, I briefly witnessed the wreckage of an alien spacecraft, as well as the remains of several alien personnel aboard the craft who were already dead. When we arrived, I learned that one of the personnel on board the craft had survived the crash and was conscious and apparently uninjured. The conscious alien was similar in appearance, but not the same as the others. None of the other personnel present could communicate with the survivor, as the being did not communicate verbally or by any recognizable signs. However, while I examined the, quote, patient for injuries, I immediately detected and understood that the alien being was trying to communicate with me by mental images or telepathic thought, which projected directly from the mind of the being. I immediately reported this phenomenon to Mr. Cabot, as no other person present could perceive these thoughts, and the alien seemed able and willing to communicate with me, it was decided after a brief consultation with a senior officer that I would accompany the surviving alien back to the base. This was partly due to the fact that I was a nurse and could attend to the physical needs of the alien as well as serve as a non-threatening communicator and companion. After all, I was the only woman at the site and the only one who was not armed. I was thereafter assigned permanently to serve as a companion to the alien at all times. My duty was to communicate with and interview the alien and to make a complete report of all I discovered to command authorities. Subsequently, I was supplied with specific lists of questions provided to me by military intelligence and non-military personnel, which I was to interpret for the alien and record the responses to the questions provided. I also accompanied the alien at all times during medical testing and other examinations to which the alien was subjected by staff from numerous government agencies. Long story short, she essentially was assigned to conduct the interviews on behalf of the military intelligence officers who composed the questions for her to ask and so on and so forth. This lasted for 6 weeks.
Hear her telepathic communication only one person. And that's an interesting thing because we have now, 60 years of contactees that are receiving communication. So I don't know if Errol was blocking communication with other people. This is an interesting point.
That question is actually answered right in the course of the interview itself. The alien says, scroll down to it.
Are you going to use ISB or alien? Alien ET or just ISB? Or do you refer to her as alien to the planet, possibly?
The nurse refers to the alien being interviewed as the alien pilot refers to herself as an officer, pilot, and engineer with the domain, which is a race of beings who recently took over this part of the galaxy, including our solar system. So she addresses herself in that fashion throughout. You really do get the sense that this is very definitely a military captive situation. She's been captured by a military force on Earth. So it's kind of like anyone else who gets captured by an enemy military force. It's, all they reveal is name, rank, and serial number to protect their own security, security of their government and so forth.
Right, until they get permission.
She refused to answer any questions given to her after a certain point of just sort of kind of rudimentary basic things which are recorded in the interview transcripts. But she tells the nurse that she's not really willing to talk to anyone except the nurse because she can read the minds of the military personnel and she doesn't trust any of them because they all have hidden intentions. Hostile intentions toward her and her race. So therefore, she was only willing to communicate with this one particular female nurse. And that situation was maintained throughout the entire course of the interviews for 6 months.
Well,
she did
as a researcher of the Roswell incident, I've heard various stories that the U.S. or the Earth government shot down the craft. I think in this rendition, Errol, the ET, says that she lost control because of lightning. And then
lightning.
I heard another one from somebody who will mention maybe later the source, but another theory was that the ship was faulty and it blew up. I've heard a number of theories. So what you're saying is that Errol was cautious about revealing her thoughts. So, and I know that the official story that Errol was saying that it was the electrical lightning failure, but maybe there's something to the theory that they shot them down. Somebody shot them down. So I don't know.
Well, you learn as you proceed reading through the transcripts and the nurse's letters, all of that is explained, and you. I don't want to jump to the end of the story, so I won't do that. But by the time you get to the end of the story and you read the final letter that was included in the package from the nurse, she explained why it was that the vehicle apparently crashed there and what the reason for it was, several reasons for the apparent crash, and that it wasn't really a crash. It was intended. It was supposed to be that way.
Oh, cool. Okay, I missed that in my research, so good.
Yeah
we
so,
have heard other things.
So according to the
interviews
between the nurse and the alien says, reveals by the end of the interviews and in the nurse's letters that it was an intentional contact being made, first of all, with this particular nurse on purpose, and secondarily with planet Earth and with our civilization as a means of delivering technology to Earth, which could then help to enhance the existing technology that was in use on Earth at that time and to kind of advance our civilization to a higher level of technology, which certainly has been the case since 1947. We've essentially, our civilization, in part by examining and reverse engineering the crashed vehicle from Roswell and others, possibly, have been able to create and develop technologies that weren't even imagined possible at that time in 1947. So,
are you familiar with The Day After Roswell by Phil Corso?
Yeah, I read that. I read that a few years ago. And the information that Philip Corso reveals in his book is very, very, it's practically identical, not in detailed description, but in the idea that the pilot in these interviews tells the military personnel during the interviews that you can take remnants of the crashed vehicle and you can examine them, and she tells them which part of the craft to use and to examine in order to advance their own technologies. These are all non-military oriented. This is not a military craft. It's more like a smaller scout craft sort of a thing. Had no particular military capability in itself, and only carried the pilot and three other personnel who were all, I guess, what would be described as gray aliens. You know, they're only like 3.5 feet tall and they're very, very fragile bodies. The three of the bodies were partially biological, I gather, but the body of the pilot was completely non-biological in nature, and a synthetic body, which she refers to as a doll body,
mm-hmm.
which I think is an apt description based on the nurse's description of the physical description as well as the capability of the body to act as an interface between the being operating the body, the pilot in this case, and using the body as an interface to actually control and navigate the spacecraft itself. So in other words, the pilot of the craft is thinking the thought, and the craft responds instantly. And so in essence, it's almost as though the pilot is causing the craft to operate and fly and navigate by thought, which is transmuted through the body into the body of the craft itself. Her body is made of the same materials that the craft is made from.
If it's of any help to those out there, it's one may think of Data from Star Trek episodes just as a parallel.
Yeah, I suppose
thought.
It could be somewhat analogous. The difference being is that in this case, the pilot of the craft, her body is fully animated by her as a spiritual source of spiritual energy, which she describes in great detail during the interviews, and has the capability of using an actual physical interface or communication channel through which to navigate the craft.
Also to help others
like
understand.
Like an avatar?
Like Philip K. Dick, and Janet, you've seen him in Today's Time in Reality in 3D? Like Philip K. Dick,
mm-hmm.
You've seen that biological android. Is that proper?
Right, but I don't think that this was really like an android per se, because the android. Well, it could be. Anyway, so let's go on.
Well,
what's the
yeah.
next thing that happens? Yeah.
Yeah. When you read the interviews and the nurse's letter, she actually describes all of this in great detail. So there's really very little left to speculations. It's actually almost faster to read the book than it is for me to describe it.
Okay.
In some ways, you know, parts of it. So I encourage everyone to read the book. It's not a long book. You can read the whole thing in 5 or 6 hours. It's recorded as an audio book, so it's very accessible over the internet as a PDF file. And a couple of different people have actually sat down on YouTube and recorded the entire book as a series of YouTube videos. There's 2 different versions of that available. So it doesn't take very long to read the entire book from first page to last, you know, 5 or 6 hours, I think.
So how long were they doing these interviews with this alien? Was it a week, a month, or what was the time frame?
6 weeks.
6 weeks, uh-huh. So what were some of the major things that we might want to pay attention to that Errol, the extraterrestrial, told humanity through Matilda, the nurse?
Well, that's a good question. Part of the information imparted by the pilot is information that's given to her in a somewhat official capacity as a representative of the intergalactic civilization, which the nurse refers to as the domain. The nurse, her impression of the meaning of the images or ideas that she got from the pilot, that their civilization could be referred to as the domain or the realm or the home or any number of words that might be appropriate in the English language, none of which were the actual words used by the pilot, because there's no English language equivalent to the name of the civilization from which the pilot
mm-hmm.
was mm-hmm. of which the pilot was a part. So they refer to it. Sorry,
go ahead.
You broke up, Dana.
They control like 25% of the universe or the galaxy or something like that?
Something like that, about 25% of the entire physical universe,
uh-huh.
is what she says. But they were the domain had sent about 3,000 personnel to our particular solar system about 10,000 years ago. They set up a little base in the Himalaya Mountains, and they set up a base in the Astro Belt, the backside of the moon, Venus, and you know, various other places that she didn't name, to act as a kind of a observation point, just minding their own business, going about invading this galaxy and this universe as a, you know, it's a military operation, obviously. And what they were doing is conquering and knocking out the existing intergalactic government and space forces and installations and everything that have existed in this galaxy for many, many billions of years, and taking it over and claiming this entire territory as their own. So
they're the U.S. They're the U.S. of the galaxy.
Yeah, kind of like they're imperialistic, you know, they're conquering. Although the pilot says, well, their intentions are principally egalitarian and humanitarian and benevolent. You know, they're not just going out and killing and slaughtering and motivated by greed and power and possession. That their overall purpose, I gather, is to try to bring a higher level of their own civilization, which is a much higher level of civilization, to other galaxies or other universes or other dimensions than what currently exists. So there are quite a few different very interesting aspects to the story that the pilot relates. At a certain stage of the interviews, the pilot refuses to answer any questions at all, and she says, I'm going to give you the information that I came here to give you and I'm authorized to give you. Some of it's my personal opinion and observation, and some of it's from the official records of my civilization, which has been observing Earth for quite a long time. And so she begins to teach the nurse lessons, so to speak, and give her information that she thinks would be useful for people on Earth to know. So the main body of the information in the interviews discusses subjects like the origin of life in the universe and the nature of life in the universe, and the spiritual nature of individual beings, regardless of what kind of life form they inhabit. She says that, in her opinion, every sentient being is an immortal spiritual being, and that this is the common denominator of all life forms throughout this universe, including herself and
does Errol have a form that she likes to be in? You know, she used this doll body to come here to Earth, but does she have her own natural form, or is she a fourth dimensional or higher level being?
Yeah, her natural form, I gather, would be to not inhabit a body of any kind.
She's just
in
spiritual.
Fact, she says that, so she's a spiritual entity, an immortal spiritual entity. And she says that the hierarchy of her organization and her civilization does not inhabit bodies. They don't. I don't know. She doesn't
more
use
than
the word,
thought form,
describes
spiritual.
That.
The history stays right, but
she
spiritual.
She uses a coined word that she. She made up to try to explain to the nurse the meaning of what she means by spiritual being. She uses the word is-be, I-S-B-E, and she gets a very specific definition of that.
Intelligent.
Term, which I could probably just read it to you. Verbatim.
Go for it. Read it to us, yes.
Yeah, it is a very specific definition, and it's not like anything I've ever read before. So let's see, she says, the pilot says, personally, it is my conviction that all sentient beings are immortal spiritual beings. This includes human beings. For the sake of accuracy and simplicity, I will use a made-up word, is being. Because the primary nature of an immortal being is that they live in a timeless state of is, and the only reason for their existence is that they decide to be. No matter how lowly their station in a society, every is-be deserves the respect and treatment that I myself would like to receive from others. Each person on Earth continues to be an is-be whether they are aware of the facts or not. that's her definition. And of course, she goes on later in the transcripts to describe a lot more about the nature of these bees in some great detail.
Well, when you say Izzy, you can say immortal spiritual being, but you can also break it down, right, into is, which is your, everything is.
It
can be double meaning.
The essential element of a spiritual being is that they exist in a timeless state of is, like in an eternal now, so to speak. And the only reason for that is because they decide to be.
They want to be,
right.
Exist. I think, therefore, so I am, was a great philosophical statement.
You make a decision to be, and then you are. And as long as you continue to decide to be, you continue to exist.
So that's important for all of us to understand where you're at right now with that statement. So even though it sounds funny, you've heard a lot of people, including Wayne Dyer, you know, talking about thoughts or things. And there's many people that would maybe want to talk about what that means. But just think of it as a title or almost like an acronym, like you explained, right? Immortal, spiritual, and then B for being. And like you said, just being and wanting to be. That's going to be a little hard for everybody to grasp because of the veil or the amnesia. But to me, that sounds logical. I would think, personally, in this lifetime. Does it not make sense?
To me, it makes sense. I mean, it's a very, very kind of succinct and abbreviated definition of what a spiritual being or what a spiritual being is. And it's about as uncomplicated as
it's what we call an acronym, is it not?
Yeah, you're in a continuous eternal state of is because you decide to be, and that's all there is to know.
Because you want to be.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what this is, the meaning. Yeah, this is a prison planet. Tell us about Earth.
That's a very interesting kind of a side story. Stephen, this group of personnel from the domain landed on Earth about 10,000 years ago. They set up a base inside of a mountain in the Himalayas with a force screen covering their installation. And so unbeknownst to them, the governmental and military forces of the existing interplanetary government at that time were still operating in this part of space and in the solar system and around this planet. And the pilot refers to that civilization as the Old Empire. She says that's not its real name, but that's kind of a catchphrase they used to refer to everything having to do with the government and the interplanetary intergalactic government they have just recently conquered. So they refer to that all as the Old Empire. It doesn't exist anymore. It's gone. However, 10,000 years ago at that time, there were still operational and still are today, I'm sure, operational elements throughout this part of the universe that are still fully in operation as the Old Empire.
Always cosmic wars. We just accept that there's always cosmic wars. And that Old Empire was the oldest description. But now, you know, Janet, we're at 11 minutes, just so Lawrence knows that it may be a wonderful thing for him to come back and share as long as both of you know. Yeah, so where we're at, and we want to discuss all the millenniums and the eons and go back to the quadrillion time frame for those that don't understand everything about time and space.
You may have that.
Spirit.
I don't think it was really covered extensively in the book. It was just kind of, that was the Old Empire, and that's the missing piece of the puzzle, like, who were they? So tell us about 10,000 years ago, they got, finish that thread there. What happened with the 3,000
feet
that came here?
The domain set up the space, and they had 3,000 people in the space, and the base was attacked and the personnel of that base were killed, blown literally out of their bodies. The bodies were killed, and they were captured as Izzy's. They were captured as spiritual beings in an electronic, by some means electronically, and captured. And they were given amnesia, and their memories were erased, and then they were put into biological bodies on Earth. They became humans on Earth, and because of this process, we're not able to remember who they are, how they got here, where they came from, and so the domain discovers sometime later that this unit of 3,000 of their personnel is missing. So they sent out subsequently other of their personnel to try to find them, and they were likewise captured, disappeared. So, but eventually they figured out that what was going on was that Earth has been being used as a prison planet for a very, very long time, and that around the Earth there is set up very elaborate machinery, electronic machinery in nature that pervades the entire planet and the adjoining areas around the planet and solar system with various kinds of force fields and captures the Izzy when it departs from the body, gives them amnesia, replaces their memory with false memories, and hypnotic suggestions and commands and so forth to return to Earth and reincarnate a new body and undergo another lifetime of trying to attain some false purpose given to them by this prison planet mechanism. The idea of the prison machinery and the prison planet mechanism is to get rid of undesirable elements of the population of the old empire governments, because the person is a political adversary, a military enemy, or they're considered to be useless people. They refer to them as untouchables, just like in India. They talk to the lowest classes of person are untouchable.
To wipe out memories and keep souls or spirits in an eternal cycle of life, birth, death, recycling, and no avenue to get out of it. There's no parole.
That's
why they were changing the old empire.
Prison, it's intended to be a perpetual prison. There's no escape. They want to get rid of you and make sure that you stay gotten rid of forever and ever. So, to that end, this particular planet was taken over and set up as a prison, and it was set up on purpose as a prison long ago, and all of the ancient civilizations of Earth, including Egypt, Babylon, so on and so forth, the pyramids, and were all built by these elements of the old empire civilization who set up a prison planet. And she refers to the pyramids and all of these prehistoric buildings, which nobody to this day understands where they came from or who built them. They were built intentionally to be mysterious and indecipherable as part of a prison plan. She refers to these as false facade civilizations, kind of like in a movie, you build a set out in the middle of the desert out of cardboard, and it's made to look like an old Western town. And it looks authentic from a distance, but when you get right up to it and push on it, it falls over because it's false, it's fake.
Right, so they erase, it's a way to erase things of coming and going from the planet to keep people dumbed down or as amnesia, right? That's one of the
The false facade civilizations of Egypt and India and Babylon and so forth and all of these prehistoric civilizations were installed on the planet, all as a whole,
Is this whole solar system part of the prison, or can you go off of the Earth and be out of this prison system?
according to what the pilot says, once you're here, there's no escape, except with a few very, very clever individuals, possibly Buddha or, you know, someone of that order.
Well, what if
who
all
might
these
individually
other,
be able to...
This is one thing that's very interesting for me. It's like, you know, I'm a ufologist, and there's all these people that are having experiences, and I've had experiences, and TJ's had experiences, which are different than what she's describing. And they involve a lot of different species, like reptilians and praying mantis and tall whites and many other different species.
Yeah, she mentions that in the course of the transcript. She says you've got the principal use of the planet. This planet was set up as a prison planet by the old empire a long, long time ago. It's been used as a prison for a long time. But those forces, the military forces of the old empire around this planet, were destroyed by the domain forces in the ending in the year about around 1215 AD, which is pretty recent. So there are no more active elements of the old empire forces operating in our solar system any longer since 1250 AD, which she mentions is coincidentally because of the erasure of the influences of the prison planet operators, so to speak, that there's been a huge resurgence in invention, innovation, technology, science, and huge advancement in technology since that time that are coincident with getting rid of the influence of the prison planet operators, so to speak.
We've only got 4 minutes here, Lawrence. Can we have you come back? Because I would love to get in discussion with you and Janet about the old empire and prior to that, the Sumerian texts with the Anunnaki and all
that.
Yeah,
well,
let me
just say one other thing to answer Janet's question specifically. The pilot of this craft, Errol, says that since the destruction of the old empire operation in this area, that many, many other adjoining galaxies and civilizations have also been bringing their unwanted or undesirable people and dumping them off on Earth and using the prison planet system for their own purposes. So you've got many, many different races of beings from many, many different galaxies all bringing people here and dumping them off on Earth because it's sort of a convenient thing to use for them, and
they could all have their own belief systems and their own gods and
their
own eons of history and their cultures, and so people don't get all offended or go off into fight or flight or go into, you know, just stand by, keep an open heart and an open mind. And we've only got a couple of minutes here, so I mean 2 minutes live on the air.
The point is pretty simple: is that there are beings on this planet from all over the place, all different times.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
So forth.
TDA, I have 4:30, which means we have another half hour. Did you set it only for 90 minutes today?
No, I didn't think I did. Hold on.
We started
it. Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, right. I can extend it. Let me extend it. Okay, excuse me. Well, we both had funny things, but no, I thought I said it for 120, but there's been some odd things. My Skype's gone, but duration 120 minutes now, so therefore, but thank you. Now we have 32 minutes. Thank you for that.
That's my thought, because I guess there's a way. You'll just show me how you can reset it, because I could have just reset my show. But anyway, so now we have more time.
Yeah, now we've got 30 minutes left. I was trying to, recap, but I see some people getting a little, they're putting their ruffling their feathers.
Let's continue with the logic of what Matilda gave to us, and then we can go.
Okay, I'd like to ask Lawrence one question, though, Janet, because she was in the... She was in the witness protection program. I'd like people to understand, please, that this is a author, Lawrence R. Spencer, that has served a purpose on Earth for another
female that was allegedly or supposedly in the witness protection program. So we may or may not know that Matilda McElroy was her original name, or was McElroy her married name. When you were talking to her,
I subsequently found that her name is entirely false. There's no record of her any place, and believe me, me and a lot of other people have spent a lot of time and energy trying to find her true identity. It's not possible. Some of the best researchers in the world cannot track her down.
Yeah, I talked to Glenn
away.
Dennis
you have
myself.
Of her on the book. Wait a minute, what else are you talking about? What about the picture you have of her on the book? Is that that's not her?
It's just a picture I found on the internet to use for
as
an illustration. There's no pictures, there's no record, there's no way to authenticate her actual identity. I mean, we've looked through high school records, we've looked through every possible place, and there's
the
no
government
record
wiped
of anybody
clean.
Under that name or any of the other five nurses that were stationed at Roswell at the same time. They just saw
I do know there was one there personally. I do know I did authenticate for some of you just in my own personal investigation on Earth in this lifetime, just for the record. But all I'm going to say.
So you authenticated one of the nurses, you're saying?
Yes, that's all I'm going to say because, you know, my husband's story and my story and the implosion, and we thought that it was lightning, but we didn't know for sure. So we don't know how much we're allowed to say either. So the reason, Lawrence, is in this lifetime I've worked both inside and outside of our government on the planet in the United States of America. Therefore, my husband is able to only say certain things. In other words, this story is a recap that this particular person told told the nurse, and I have done somewhat of a mini little information background check on myself backwards to the story to Roswell, been there, and then talked with Glenn Dennis, you know, that was running the little Roswell UFO Museum. But anyway, I'm just saying that there's different stories that may mesh. And so everybody keep an open mind that all these stories can mesh, and you can either accept it verbatim or not. And it could be an intro into the Bible or not. You know, it could be into the Sumerian text or not. So when you start putting all these things together, it's up to each individual spirit to decide what you want to believe. So we're just being open-minded here. But, Lawrence, I think it's a wonderful book, and I can't wait to read it. So now we have roughly 28 minutes, and there's a lot of time in there. Can you just sort of give a basic oversight of the timeline that goes all the way back and forward that for people? And I mean, it's very interesting, the topics.
Well, let him finish what happened with the interviews, and then we can go into that.
Okay, you've got 27 minutes.
Yeah.
If you want, you want to just wherever you're at, keep going and see if people will respond. That's fine. We can come back later for more detail.
There's lots of different kinds of information that the pilot gives to the nurse. But as far as the events of Earth that are relevant to the people who currently inhabit Earth, the essential kernel of idea that she describes is that everyone on this planet is an immortal spiritual being. They were all murdered and captured and taken away from the planets from where they came and the galaxies or systems from which they came, put in this prison planet, were given amnesia and false memories, false identity, false everything, and have been kept here on purpose within this the mechanisms that were set up surrounding Earth that are form an electromagnetic part of the electromagnetic fields of Earth, reinforce the amnesia and memory loss and hypnotic suggestions and so forth that make it appear to everybody inhabiting bodies on Earth that we are all from Earth, and this is where our species evolved, the highest form of life on Earth and in the galaxies and so forth, all of which is a lie. It's all part of the false facade created by the prison system to create the illusion that we are from Earth. This is our home. So that mechanism serves to reinforce the amnesia mechanism. Because if you believe in the theory of evolution, which is another part of this lie, this false construct, and you believe that, you know, your ancestors evolved out of some primordial goo in some swamp, you know, 4 billion years ago, and that the Earth is only 4 billion years old, and so on and so forth. This is all part of the false propaganda of the prison planet. And it's very, very knowingly and precisely put together in that way to prevent Isbys on Earth from remembering who they really are, where they came from, who brought them here, why they brought them here, and so on. So it makes a very, very neat, convenient prison system plan.
Right.
You're inhabiting a biological body to begin with.
We're all still in this
another
mechanism.
Part of the prison.
It came down, and that's why we started to get inventions and get, we were like really in the dark ages until part of the mechanism was destroyed in one of the attacks from the Isbys on the mechanism. Right?
Yeah, when the old empire forces were finally wiped out around 1250 AD, then the influence of the amnesia and prison planet system began to weaken considerably. And since that time, there's been a huge renaissance, a revolution in thought, spirituality, technology, science, so on and so forth. But that doesn't negate the fact that we're still living within this prison planet mechanism, which is very, very much still in operation, and that inhabiting a biological body, as we do on Earth, is another part of that prison system. Because it's obvious to anybody who studied that if you're inhabiting a biological body on Earth, that your ability to perceive and interact with the full spectrum of perception in this universe, the whole electromagnetic spectrum and so forth, is just a tiny, tiny little sliver of everything that there is to be perceived. Because you can only see with your eyes and hear with your ears and feel with your touch about 1/1,000,000 of the entire electromagnetic spectrum of information and phenomena that exist just in this universe, much less other dimensions or what have you. So that the biological body, the pilot says, was created some many billions of years ago specifically as a trap for Isbys to draw them into inhabiting this tiny little itty bitty piece of flesh and keeping them inside of it, and so that you can inflict pain on them and deprivation and control them in many, many other ways. And it makes a very, very integral part of the prison system, the biological body.
So when they came down to the Himalayas, when they got trapped into this system, there were these biological bodies here, and they weren't aware until after they got trapped that there was this whole old empire system.
There were biological bodies here. There were human beings living on Earth, but they themselves, as the main force, were not human beings. They're not even from this. Apparently, they're not even from this universe. They're from a different universe altogether.
There were humanoids living on the Earth when they came down to the Himalayas, right?
Yeah, the prison planet already existed at that time, long before 10,000
right.
years ago.
That was the old empire, Janet, not the level that she came with. She was only working with a communication officer with the domain. If you understand, the domain is not the old empire. So we're talking about two factions.
No,
two completely opposing forces. Yes.
Right. So when the original 3,000 got trapped and they came to Earth, what form were they in?
They were aboard a spacecraft inhabiting either no bodies at all or inhabiting, artificially constructed bodies for the purposes of performing very specific kinds of functions. The pilot describes in the domain, bodies are manufactured for specific use, and then ISBE inhabits the body and animates the body for like a tool for a specific function or a specific use according to what their job is. But the hierarchy,
so thousand years ago,
vast majority
of
the domain
bodies
don't.
Well, think about it, Jan. We have biologicals on this planet.
This is my question. When they came down their manufactured bodies, did they encounter any humanoids 10,000 years ago?
Yes.
Okay.
The prison planet already existed.
What did those were?
They thought they were biological bodies. They didn't apparently pay very much attention to them. They thought they were like...
That was a piece I missed.
Yeah, no, the domain has been, the pilot explains, the domain is very fully aware of biological bodies, and the biological bodies were engineered on purpose billions and billions of years ago throughout the universe, this universe, for use, for ISBEs to use to play games or to have adventures or... as part of the prison planet, they're used as a way of a trapping mechanism, a way of keeping an ISBE in a state of amnesia and unawareness and disability.
So the biological bodies throughout the universe are not necessarily, you don't really have amnesia, only the ones that are here on Earth have added.
Yeah, the whole amnesia phenomenon is just Earth. Just inside the prison planet.
When you're in a physical body, though, Gene, because think about the Anunnaki and all spiritual beings are spirits. And then what I believe that this particular book and this particular story is about is the fact that we're all spiritual beings, right? No matter what form we take, so biologically on this planet. Does that make sense? In other words, you are immortal. Everyone is immortal. We're all made out of, for scientific purposes, let's say, stardust, except for the helium and the hydrogen, which comes from the universal source here for this particular universe. But remember, we think of multi-universes and multi-dimensions. So some of that is covered in time expansion by what we call time on this particular location, right, from our point of origin, which you always say there's no time and space, really, if you start with a point of origin spirit.
What we're saying is that there are ISBEs, we're all ISBEs. There are biological forms throughout the universe, and the biological forms on the Earth are the only ones that have this amnesia. But throughout the universe, biological forms exist for what purpose? Just for entertainment, recreation, coming down to
spirit?
Well,
we all have truth.
Yeah,
for whatever purpose
the ISBE decides to use them for.
Okay.
She says, the pilot says that there are as many different kinds of life forms as there are grains of sand on the beach. There are nearly unlimited number of life forms, types of life forms. Species.
And there's some that can be created.
What happened
all the
to Errol the gray is the doll baby gray, doll body gray is the Errol.
Yeah, at the very end of the interviews, the nurse gives Errol a copy of the transcripts to sign off on at the request of the military officers there, and she refuses to sign off. So at that moment...
she's going to leave. She's not going to stay. And she knows that, but she's already made...
What happened? And then we'll go after it.
So
go ahead.
At the very moment that she refuses to sign the document specifying that this is accurate, several MPs with weapons rush into the room with a doctor. They pick up the little doll body. It's like just a tiny little thing. Put it on a gurney, and they put electrodes on the head of the alien and give it an electric shock and subdue it and take it out of the room, take it down to a different room, and the alien is submitted to electric shock for several days thereafter in an attempt to try to get it to confess or reveal information that the military is interested in. But what occurred at the instant that the MPs come rushing into the room, the ISBE departs from the doll body and returns to her base.
Didn't she tell the nurse the day before that I'm going to leave my body?
She says, uh-huh. I've told you everything I have to tell you, and there's nothing else I have to tell you, so I'm going to be leaving. At which point she tells the military authorities, well, that the pilot says that she's told us everything she's going to tell us, and she's going to leave. And this is when they decide to try to force the pilot to sign off on the transcript, saying, yes, these are authentic, it's accurate, and so forth. She refuses to do so. They pick up her body, they give it electric shocks and so forth in an attempt to force.
But she's already gone.
She's not there.
See, Jenny, it's like when you say, but Lord, he stinketh, you know, and he raises, in other words, your body, I've passed over a couple of times, Lawrence, so I totally get this. In other words, you can come and go from your physical body even in this lifetime, in this life form. It's no big deal when you're immortal in your spirit. And I think that's what she was trying to explain. It's another one of those stories.
Didn't kill her. She just left.
Janet. You can come and go out of this body, but most people leave them decayed.
The pilot says
remember the Avatar thing, the movie The Avatar?
I get it. Yeah, we're using analogies, folks.
Her Avatar. They didn't kill her. She left. Okay.
Well, yeah. You're attached to, your spirit immortal anyway. And, you can think of it that way as an avatar. Sure. Because spiritually, you just go back to your other universe or your other, if you want to, this space station, if you want. You know, in other words, wherever your spirit needs to go back to, it does, even in this lifetime. It's the same story. So it's just up to individuals whether they want
to
believe that.
Matilda, our hero, what happens to her after this?
Well, she's she says this in her letter, she's immediately discharged and put in this witness protection program, and that's the end of the story for her, except that she was able to maintain communication with the pilot telepathically over the 60 years after 1947, and as a result of that, was able to help restore her own memory of the fact that she herself was one of the 3,000 domain personnel that were captured.
Expedition.
She was one of those 3,000.
She went to Montana. Remember where Sorelli's is, and then to Ireland, right, Lawrence?
Yeah.
Even though she was in the witness protection program. But she told you that, right? Or you had it in writing?
It says in the letters. It's published in the book. I published the book. I published everything that she sent me verbatim. I didn't alter a single letter of it. I just published it exactly the way she sent it to me.
I wanted to make sure everybody understood that was by your choice.
That's what she asked me to do in her final letter. She says, can you please, I'm sending this to you. Can you please publish it because I can't do it, I need to trust somebody who I think is able to do it and would understand the significance of the material to do it. So for whatever reason, she sent it to me. I think because she had read the book I wrote 10 years before, and she thought, okay, well, here's somebody obviously who can publish a book and who would understand how important this information is. So she sent it to me, and I did it.
Did you share her notes in your book? Because I haven't read it yet. Did you discuss
it? It's all in there. Every single word without addition or alteration. All I did is I just sat down and I organized it into what seemed to be the linear fashion, and then I just typed it all in the computer verbatim.
Great.
And then I
plus,
just shared
I did go over to Ireland and see if you could find a couple that had killed themselves or
no,
time period.
Yeah, I did not do that personally, but a friend of mine who lives in the same county where she, from which the envelope was mailed, County Meath, Ireland, which is not far from Dublin, his father and himself own a horse breeding farm there in that county, which is like just literally 10-minute drive from the address given in the letter. So he went over there himself, and he's lived there his whole life and still does. He went over there. He went to the address that the nurse gave. He went to the hospital. He went to the mortuary. He went to the graveyard. Absolutely no evidence at all, period, of anything having to do with anybody by the name of McElroy or O'Donnell. Nothing.
Were there any couples that killed themselves simultaneously or
no record of any he couldn't find any evidence that these people ever existed at all, period.
But it was postmarked from that town.
Yes, the postmark was definitely from the post office in County Meath, Ireland.
Wow. And
there's no mistaking that.
No,
I put the exact physical address that was on the envelope. But what I've discovered from other researchers over the years, and people who know a hell of a lot more about this than I do, is that this is pretty typical of government cover-up operations and witness protection, where the government is trying to keep someone's identity secret. They can erase you from the earth. They can erase every particle of evidence that you ever existed. And they seem to have done a very, very thorough job with regard to Roswell.
Gone to a different town to send that to you. Maybe it traveled from, another county, or maybe even came over from the UK
anything is possible.
Yeah. Just to throw you off, thinking that's where she was.
The point is, we either believe stories or we don't, and we each as a spirit have to discern for ourselves. However,
exactly.
I believe that as spirits, we also work together on a planet and a critical mass mind, and I believe that's why the importance of getting this information out is so important. Now, whether people want to choose for their own spiritual self to believe or not, that's not what we're about, folks, and that was the whole point of Lawrence being given this particular document. This top secret document, and I know some of you are going to say it didn't have a seal or this and yada, 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 but the thing is, she was in there in the room, the nurse with this person, the only person that this entity, being a mortal spiritual being, would speak with was this woman because of the telepathic abilities and because she was able to discern that this woman was of noble intellect and moral turpitude and humbleness of all the things that these people in the military, if you put yourself in their position, they were all about hunger and greed and status and political position. Now, remember, she was a pilot and she was an engineer and she was working with a commander, but she was the commander of that ship. But in order to speak, she had to work with her communication officer above for the domain in the space station. And we all have abilities, and every one of us as a spirit can choose to believe or not believe what Lawrence is projecting in his book to you as the editor, which also goes back to the Oz factor, which we weren't able to cover today. But this woman believed so much in Mr. Spencer for getting in touch with her prior for the Oz factor that she trusted him with her only source of this truth ever being truth to her, and that was this top secret document. So you've got to understand, we don't need all these copies or getting in all the details and splitting hairs. The fact was, this was the only copy she was sent back into that room, and the military in charge, Helen Collar and all these people that were there, they knew she had said she was going to leave. But she can leave because she's spiritual. She is an ISBE. She is an intelligent, immortal spiritual being that comes and goes from this planet. So a lot of you will have to decide whether you want to believe this or not, like you believe in the
Vedas.
Right.
TJ, Okay. So is there anything regarding your knowledge and his? See, I know, but I can't reveal what TJ knows. So TJ has to decide what she's going to say about what she knows.
Well, I think we should have him come back because everybody has their own truth, and everybody is just like saying everybody has their own source.
No. You have a piece that you know that would be.
That's why I said we're out of time, Janet. I would be more than happy to address that, but I believe that Lawrence has done a wonderful job in prior interviews to stand alone, and the fact is that this is an important document. And it does need to be out there, folks, so please be objective and be open-minded to at least read his book, which is available on Amazon or Lulu.com. He has an e-book, our PDF form, if you will. And let's go over the last 5 minutes, and then Mr. Spencer, would you be willing to share another portion of your life on this planet with Janet and I?
Well, one of the things that I realized when I received these documents from the nurse and more every day as I continue to discuss it with people and talk about it and do whatever I can to help people who are volunteering to do translations and so forth, is that I'm kind of like a messenger here. I didn't ask to be a messenger, but I was given this material, and I think for whatever reason, it really doesn't have anything to do with me personally, as I'm really just a messenger. I'm like the postman. I'm delivering the mail. I didn't write the mail. I don't read the mail. I don't really know anything about the mail. All I do is deliver the mail. So
right.
I feel that my experience in this whole thing over the last 7 years or so becomes more and more simple and real to me every day, that all I'm doing is being the mailman. I'm just delivering the message to people in whatever form possible. I'm beginning to do some public lectures. I put together a wonderful PowerPoint presentation together with audio files from the audiobook that I'm going to be giving as a live presentation at the end of July. I've appeared on many, many internet radio shows and have been invited to appear on many more. And I'm assisting with the development of a film based on the book. And I did write a science fiction sequel, if you will, to the Alien Interview book called The Domain Expeditionary Force Rescue Mission. I wrote this book several years ago at the request of people who were developing the film script at that time. Based on my own personal understanding and study of the information in the Alien Interview transcripts as to the nature and activity of the domain. It's my own, sort of personal musings and imagination about what would the domain look like and how would that civilization operate and so on and so forth. So that book is also available if anybody cares to read it. The blog
okay, now what was the name of that book? Because we'd like to have you come back and share that as well. That would be wonderful if you could do that.
It's called the Domain Expeditionary Force Rescue Mission.
The Domain Expeditionary Force Rescue Mission. Okay, and that is available on Lulu.
And Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever.
Wonderful.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you can get it just about anywhere.
Great.
But it has to do with the story, the part of the Alien Interview story that the pilot relates about after the 3,000 members of the Domain Force were captured in the Himalayas, it describes all of the activities of other officers and members of the Domain going out to search for them and try to find them all over the world and under the ocean. All over the planet trying to find these 3,000 lost members of their own personnel, which they did succeed in doing, and she describes exactly how they did it, where they did it, when they did it, and it ties in directly to the Anunnaki and to the ancient civilizations of Earth. And that is a very, very compelling story in itself, which you can read about in Alien Interview.
So So that's in the Domain Expeditionary Force rescue mission, or in the original?
It's in the original book, but my science fiction story is based on my assumptions or imagination about the activities of the domain as a whole.
Somebody here is saying how it compares to the Billy Myers story, but that, again, is also a story, folks. So in light of all this, yes, they are all stories.
We have 1 minute,
TJ.
We want to just let you know we're going off air. 1 minute. So, Lawrence, what's your website for our listeners?
Yeah, I would encourage people to read the website. It has all the content of the book, the footnotes, everything is on there, all kinds of videos, et cetera. It's alieninterview.org/blog. alieninterview.org/blog.
Blog. Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got 12 seconds. And then we can go into archive, folks, and you can just hear whatever we say on the archive because they allow us to go over roughly an hour, but I don't know that we would stay, that we could come back later. So a lot of people, we're off air now. We're off live,
right.
But we've got time to close this out for people that Lawrence, just so you know, people will still hear us just like we're live on the air. Once,
okay.
In other words, this is being recorded until we hang up, as long as we hang up within 1 hour's time. I always call this the Ace Folk Life Hour because it's a contributory, I guess, by blog. I don't know if they want me to advertise it or not, but I've just noticed, and probably many of our Blog Talk Radio hosts do know that when you pay for a prime time and you're on, it may kick out your people, their own smartphones or people in certain areas, but the archive can be picked up. So would you like to share in the future that we may be able to do this again? It seemed like it went by awfully fast.
I can't believe that was 2 hours.
I can't either. I mean, it's like
I kept wanting to say something. I actually did a series of radio show interviews a year or two ago on Exopolitics Radio that were a series of 5 hours.
Wow.
The interview lasted for 5 hours. Which
was
is
that
the
Alfred
same length of,
Weber? Was that Alfred Weber?
No. It was the guy who's the head of Exopolitics Ohio. He has his own radio show. Mark Snyder is his name.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, my point was that in the 5 hours that I did radio show interviews with him discussing the book, you can actually read the entire book live on the air in 5 hours. That's the length
so
of the audio book. The audio book
so
is 5 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Have you approved all these people reading it? Because some of them I've caught, like maybe chapter 8 here or chapter 9 there. I had one female English voice, and then I heard one guy. But when one of the gentlemen on his show or whatever, he was showing words, but then when he would read them, they wouldn't match the words. I don't know if you've caught that or not. So how are you working with all these people?
I don't work with them all. I only know two people personally who have did YouTube readings of the book on their YouTube channels, and I've talked with both of these guys at length, you know, after the fact that they're having done it, published it without any permission. Contacted them and said, you know, I really want you to know it's totally okay with me that you're doing this. My only concern is I don't want you to alter the information or add something to it. But if you just want to go on your YouTube channel and read the book aloud to your subscribers, fine, great, go for it. So all I'm trying to do is to deliver the information. I'm just trying to get the message delivered in any way possible. So,
I'm
working with translators around the world, and there has been a tremendous recent growth of interest in the book because now it's been out for about 6 years, and the more people who read it and hear about it, they start talking to other people and so on and so forth. So it's kind of snowballing into a much bigger deal than I ever imagined.
And now you're going into a movie. And I would love to know if it's a documentary. Can you say, is it a documentary?
Independently produced and distributed film, funded, probably to be filmed in China.
Actor type film with characters being acted out and having a rendition of the gray, or is it going to be like a documentary?
The script, the current script is a theatrical film. So,
okay.
You know, with actors and actresses and on location shooting and big budget and the whole deal.
Are they going to
have
you as a consultant?
Pardon?
Are they
going to
have you on the set as a consultant? Or
I'll definitely be on set as a consultant. But the people who are doing the project are very, very thoroughly qualified to make feature films, and they've made many, many, many feature films that you would instantly recognize. Work in television on the most popular television programs currently being aired on television. So these are very highly qualified people.
Wonderful. Well, so they'll have a military consultant as well for that time frame
proper. I'm sure Hollywood has to bow down to the CIA and so on and so forth. As far as I've been told, the CIA pretty much controls Hollywood. Pretty well known fact within the inner circles of Hollywood also, as I've been told, by people who work there.
With that being said, that nothing happens by accident, especially with the CIA, there's some reason they want this information released at this time.
I don't know whether or not that's true. I don't think anybody knows that the information is being released. I haven't discussed the film with anybody. I mean, I've never even mentioned it except for you guys. Part of the deal with films is it takes years typically to put together a feature film and get it into production and editing and distribution. So it may be several years, if at all.
It's part of the loop that they're controlling here on this planet.
Right.
With this intelligence agency.
When Sitchin was alive in 2005, there was a big conference, and finally, the story was going to get put out in a book, in a movie film, and it never got made. That was part of the squelching of the information. And nobody was, the other people dropped off. Okay, it's getting made. We don't need to do it.
Yeah.
And
just between you and me, I would be very, very surprised if this book ever gets made into a film. I'd be really, really surprised. In spite of the best intentions and qualifications of the people involved, I just don't think this information is going to be allowed to see the light of day on a screen in a movie theater in the United States.
That's because people don't really read books much anymore. We've got an ADHD society. They have very small attention span. They're more likely to watch a movie, but like you said, the likelihood of that getting produced is small, and that's how they control the information, mainly because the whole society, they're just not reading books like they used to.
I think it'd make a wonderful movie, though, even if it comes from the book exactly as William R. Spencer wrote it. The book, as Alien Interview, it's based on Alien Interview. They can use that for the movie. And what's the difference in Gene Roddenberry's with the 9 Star Trek? Because all of that came right out.
Gene Roddenberry fictionalized it. And Lawrence
or Star Wars with George Lucas.
It's all fiction, and they let fiction out there. But this is being touted as based on truth.
The script that has been written for the film version of this book is as you say, it is highly fictionalized. It's not a documentary film.
Right. Anyway. So what they could do is use the old empire and the domain, and then also if they can bring it up to date, is that there are higher levels and get into the universes, not just this particular universe.
They probably
aren't going to cover all that because it's too hard to. I haven't seen anybody really cover it even on a radio show today. So maybe that's something you could do to fill in because nobody really knows all the levels all the way up to the highest level.
Exactly.
We're down here in the Matrix. All we know is this part of the galaxy, and it's based on Eternal Wars. But you know, all the way up to Source, they're not going to have a system
cosmic
of wars. This is called the one
in
God
the
universe. The cosmic wars is only part of existence, and that's what we're locked in. We're locked in this story within a story within a story, where we have these wars, and the space.
What's wrong? Something's happening, Janet. Is that you or is that Lawrence?
That's not,
is that you, Lawrence?
I don't know. Maybe it's time to quit. Lawrence?
No, that's me.
Oh. Well, Lawrence,
excuse me. I didn't get to finish eating my dinner, so I'm walking through the living room. My wife is watching a television show.
Yeah, it's for us to have dinner, TJ, so we're going to have to
okay.
go.
Okay. Okay, well, Lawrence, I'd love to have another chance to talk with you from a human level in 3D again, if that's possible.
Sure, I'd be delighted anytime.
Okay, well, we'll talk about scheduling out the air maybe next week. That'll work for Lawrence. And so do you have any exit music or anything? Let's all say goodbye to our people, and then
Yes, and Lawrence, feel free. I mean, we'd love to have you back on the radio show so others can hear as well. So let's possibly just discuss something in the coming year and maybe in 2015 as well. But anytime soon would be very nice, Janet. You know how you'll book weekly sequels.
Yeah, we could do it. Let's talk about the scheduling off the air, though, okay, because I think it's time to go.
I just want to give people something to have hope. Remember hope and joy?
Let you know, listeners, when we've got Lawrence scheduled again. All right?
Yeah, I'm always available, so just tell me when and where, and I'll appear.
Okay, how about
what
next
a wonderful
week?
Attitude. Thank you so much. Thank you, Janet. Yes,
Would next Wednesday work for you?
Excellent. I'm supportive.
Okay,
brilliant. If Lawrence is agreeable.
Sure.
Okay.
No problem.
A continuation, folks.
So next week, same time, 3 to 5 Hawaiian. What is that? 6 to 8, 6 to 8 Pacific. And your time is, what is it for you, TJ?
In my time zone, on Central Time.
Is? From what time to what time?
2000, 8 p.m.
8 to 10 p.m. All right, well, that's a wrap. So goodbye, love and blessings and aloha.
Okay, thanks for having me, Lawrence. And nice to talk to you. I'll look forward
to talking to you again. Thank you, Lawrence.
Okay.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, we appreciate you
just
so much.
Exit music, TJ.
Yes.
Let's
okay.
Okay.
Exit music. Okay, thank you. Okay, here we go. Ended song.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night.
When you're down and troubled and you need some love and care and nothing's going. And soon I will be there to brighten up even your darkest night. You just call out my name and you know wherever I am. Winter, spring, summer, or fall, all you've got to do is call, and I'll be there, yes I will,
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.